I was called a gangster. That broke my heart to be called a gangster, because I've never been a gangster. And all of a sudden, one of my family come driving round. Jim, I've got your boxing gear in the... He must have been round my house. You've got your boxing gear in the... Terry wants to see you at White City. You're sparring with Muhammad Ali. Well, that's what makes a good trainer, what you've just gone from. They're all different styles. You've got to have the ability to do their style. And not only do it, not just talk it, but when they do something wrong, you go, hold it, look, I'll show you. Off comes, and then you start shaping up, taking them off. That's what, slip and hook. Don't slip and do nothing. Slip, hook, you can either go that way to the body, or you can go that way over the top, whatever way you want to go. Now, I had the ability, I'm not being big-headed, but I had the ability to take anyone's style off to make them better.
When was the last time you cried?
When the old woman had a go at me.
Hello and welcome to this week's Boxing Life Stories with me, Tris Dixon. I should actually, as you start listening to this, be working in America. I should be heading to Denver to speak with Terence Crawford today, having spent a couple of days with Amir Khan in San Francisco for BT Sports No Filter Boxing. But I'm delighted to say that this week's guest on the podcast is iconic British boxing trainer Jimmy Tibbs. I recently caught up with Jimmy at the Peacock Gym in Canning Town, which is Jimmy's manor, if you were. It's his hometown. And we spoke about all manner of things for this pod. We spoke about his time in prison, finding God, his own boxing career, some of his highs and lows as a coach, what it takes to be a good coach, and much, much more. Incidentally, one thing we didn't talk about was that Jimmy's actually also survived cancer, as well as coming through a lot in his time on this earth. It was an absolute privilege to spend some time with Jimmy. It was set up by his son Mark, who's a good friend of mine. I appreciate him linking me up with Jimmy, and we'll have to get Mark on before long as well. Just as a note, as we have each week, this podcast wouldn't be happening without the guys at Hanson Lee Resourcing, who are leading providers of technology and business change professionals, and they're proud to sponsor this podcast. Whether your business is an SME or multinational PLC, they'll work with you to identify and recruit the best permanent or interim professionals and mitigate the risk of recruitment and help retain your talent. Discover more at hansonlee.com. But for now, here's the brilliant Jimmy Tibbs. So, Jimmy, to get things started, how good a trainer is this Mark Tibbs fella?
My son Mark, he's a very good trainer. He's everyone he's trained, he knows what to do to give him the right condition. And remember, you've got to remember one thing, you don't train everyone the same, in my eyes, because everyone's different. So you adapt to their style, and if you think there's anything wrong with their style, you've got to have the ability to show them, not just talk, to show them why it's wrong. And he can do that. He's got the ability to do that. That's why I think he's a very good trainer.
Did he get that from you? Is that one of your qualities?
That's what
I
do.
You can't be a shrinking violet here now, because those listening will know that you're one of the great UK trainers of all time.
Well, maybe he has. I think he has. But we worked together a few times with Billy Joe, the heavyweight Dillian White, and a few other fighters. I work with all these fighters. I do the cuts now. I don't do no more training. I've retired from training fighters. But I've still kept in the game because I love the game still. So I'm a cut man. And I've been very, very busy with it. So that's why getting back to Mark, he's a good trainer.
Do you see yourself in him?
Well, everyone says we're like, he's the spitting image of me. And
Do you see it in the characteristics?
A couple of times. I mean, we were out yesterday, me, Mark, his wife, Melissa, and the little boy, Mark Jr. And we have a little chat about one or two things, about boxing, about different things, and I can see resemblances of me when I was a young man.
Could he be a better trainer than you were?
When you come back in about 20 years' time and ask me that question, I'll be able to give you the answer.
Once he's got the CV that matches. Okay. As a fighter, so I was doing some research on you yesterday ahead of doing this, and I was informed that you were a tidy box puncher, but quite an aggressive boxer puncher. Is that right?
Yeah, that was my style. I could box when I wanted to box, if I had to box, and I could fight if I had to fight, you know.
Did you prefer doing one or the other? Did you like a tear-up, or did you get as much pleasure from outboxing someone?
Well, I've got a pleasure of outboxing people. I like people to come to me. I was a good counter-puncher. When I first turned pro, they tried to change my style a bit by going forward. I could go forward at the right time. I knew that even then. At the right time, you go forward. Like, I like them to come on, you give them a jab, right hand, left hook, shake them up a bit, then step forward.
You started boxing at about 10 or 11, that's right?
11 years of age, yeah.
And how did that come about, where you went to the gym? Was it a rite of passage with your dad taking you and so forth?
He took me, I said I want to do a bit of boxing, because they had boxing at schools then. I went to St Bonaventure's Senior School, and they had the Great Britain Championships. You know, that's England, Ireland, no, not Ireland, England, Scotland and Wales. And so, talking about going to boxing club, all the Canning Town people went to West End then. So he took me along. First, I was 11 years of age. I think he paid 5 shillings for me to join. That's the only time he went up there, except for when I was boxing. And I'd done very well there with Jackie Gubbins to finish up my main trainer. And I enjoyed every minute of it. Loved it.
You were a good junior, weren't you?
Yeah, I won a lot of titles as a junior. Yeah.
And did you take to it naturally? Was
yeah,
it something that
I picked
that
everything
you...
up quick.
Yeah.
When I first went there, I didn't know a lot of people. You knew him at schools and doing things, but I started punching the bag, and Jackie Gubbins was watching me, and he could see that I had some more to come out. Like, I could see things when kids turn pro, and you can see what they're doing, but you can see a little bit more in them. They've got it, you know, and you try them out, and they generally make good.
Yeah. Did you think not just that you could make a living from being a professional, but did you think that you could be a serious contender?
What, trainer?
As a fighter.
Oh yeah, I turned professional to be a champion. I did. I turned professional to be a champion. But see, a lot of people don't know this, what I'm going to say. It's nothing wrong with what I'm going to say. When I turned professional, all my family are big, 6'2" people, big. My dad was 6'3", 6'4", 15, 16, 17 stone, big men. My brothers are all big, and they thought when I turned pro, even though I was weighing about 12 stone, 11, I was going to be an heavyweight. I mean, I've got a program indoors with him. When I boxed at South London, Manor Place Baths, that was my second fight. My first fight debut was at Royal Albert Hall. I boxed a week later at Manor Place Baths. Johnny Kramer was top in the bill, and I was the undercard, 6-rounder, same as lots of other people. And I looked at the program. There was Henry Cooper sitting there with the reference. We became friends after this. He's waiting for Jimmy Tibbs to get a bit bigger so they can meet. Henry Cooper.
Yeah.
And I was never a light heavyweight. Never mind about heavyweight. I was super middleweight they got today, but they didn't have them in them days.
Yeah, of course.
So I turned pro as a light heavyweight. I won most of my fights. But when it comes to fighting good light heavyweights, good fighters, it was hard.
They were that bit too big and
they
strong.
They were too big.
Yeah.
They was coming down from 13 and a half to 12-7. I was 11-11. Yeah. 12 stone when I fought Johnny Old.
Yeah.
He beat me, my first defeat. Fair and square. He beat me with my own jab. He out-jabbed me. After I got stopped in 2 rounds with Guinea Roger, he weighed 13 stone. I used to spar with him regular.
Did
it
you?
It was always hard with him. Yeah.
Well, I understand about Guinea Roger that he didn't have the best record, but no one really wanted to fight him.
No.
And he's the only guy that stopped you, isn't he?
Yes. Well, this is what happened. I'll tell you what happened. I was second on the bill at Shoreditch Town Hall. Alan Rudkin was topping the bill. And my opponent fell out. And because I sparred with Guinea Roger quite a bit up in Al Phillips' gym up in West End, they said, "Want to fight?" The worst thing you can do, and I'm not putting anyone down, Mickey Duff, Terry Lawrence, because they've been in the game a lot more years than I was.
Yes.
But the worst thing you can say to a fighter is, "Do you want to fight so-and-so?" A fighter will never say no.
Yeah.
Too much pride. They'll always, They said to me, do you want to fight Mike Tyson, but you ain't going to get a lot of money. I'd still say, oh, I'll fight him then. Because
yeah,
of pride.
Now. Yeah,
pride,
yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's pride, but you don't never say that. Anyway, I said, yeah, oh, they said, Ginny Rogers step in. So I went, okay, but I thought, this is going to be hard. This is going to be hard. Two rounds he done me in, and he caught me with a left hook. I missed the right hand, caught me with a left hook. But after that, I said to Terry, I'm going down the middles. That's when I went down the middles. Middleweights.
Okay.
No, not right afterwards, because I fought the champion of Italy after that, Franco Maccia. And he cut my eye in the first round and knocked him out in six rounds. So it was a comeback. Everyone forgot about the defeat. They generally do. Come back on a big eye. But I still wasn't happy being a light heavyweight because I was thinking ahead when I fight a good class like Eddie Aboff, people like that.
Yeah,
big
sure.
men, good fighters. I had the same amount of ability, but I wasn't big enough for them.
Yeah, of course.
I'm not making that an excuse. I got beat by Johnny Old fair and square. And I hold my hands up. I went round and see him afterwards. So, don't you? You know?
Yeah.
So that's, you know.
And then the wheels came off your pro career because of why?
The wheels come off my career because a good family member got seriously hurt in a fight. And I cut a long story short, I decided to take the law into my own hands. I did. I'd done something I shouldn't have done. I got arrested, I got convicted, and I got 10 years. So that was the end of my boxing career. So I fought.
So did you? But you thought you knew you were gonna. You knew in your mind straight away with a 10-year sentence, you weren't gonna fight again.
Yes, that's what I knew. But I didn't know this. While I was away, all I'd done was train.
Okay.
Not boxing training because they didn't allow it then. I used to run. I could run from here to South End and back. I was always keep fit. I've always kept fit in my life anyway, but they let me get on with it. When you've been in prison for a little while, they can suss what type of person you are, and if you don't cause too much aggravation, you know, you get on with it. It's different today because the world's different today. The world's different. And I kept myself fit. I come out of prison when I was about 30 years of age.
Okay.
I wished that I'd have asked to get my licence back, because that would have been in my prime. A couple of easy fights and back in
it. You would have got it. I didn't think I would.
But,
so you just didn't
try. But Terry Lawless asked me one day when I was working with him, why didn't you apply? And I told him the same thing I'm telling you. Well, I didn't want to go up in front of the board and they embarrassed me, like, you thought you could do this, you know, about doing, you know, like, people got hurt on both sides. But anyway, but I finished up going up to the board with Terry Lawless to get my trainer's licence. So it all come out anyway.
Yeah. It was a family feud. You went to prison. The charge was attempted murder, wasn't it?
Yes, yes.
And your dad and your brother went with you?
Yes.
You all got sent down?
Yes.
And was it deserved?
Not for me, dad, it wasn't, no. It was for me, it was deserved, yeah.
Okay. What did you do?
What, how long?
No, what did you do it, to get in there?
I'd rather not say.
Okay.
I'd rather not say it, you don't mind, Chris.
No, you know, as a journalist, you know, I've got to ask the
question.
Yeah,
that's fair enough. Yeah. As a journalist, I think I've got all over that now, and that's behind me now, 40 years ago.
Yeah, of course.
So, I mean, I can't even go to America because of that.
Well, that sort of plugs into something I was going to ask you later on.
Yeah.
But growing up in the East End, then obviously we're very much on your manor now in Canning Town. The underworld of London was rife, wasn't it?
It's become
a famous period of time, isn't it?
Yeah, Chris, what it is, mate. See, when we got arrested, the film came out, The Godfather.
Right.
So the papers made my dad the Godfather. Right. And we was his army, whatever they want to call it. I was called a gangster. That broke my heart to be called a gangster, because I've never been a gangster. All I've done and all my family have always done in Canning Town, well known, everyone knew the Tibbses, is help people. But this incident that happened with my brother couldn't be overlooked, because when you're young, something had to be done about it. And I've done what I had to do. And I got nicked because they grasped me, the gangsters. They thought they was gangsters. They all grasped me, and I got 10 years.
Yeah. what was it like, the East End then? You know, people obviously talk about the Richardsons, the craze and stuff. Was it, how different was it to how it is now?
How different how it is today till it was then?
Yeah.
Oh, well, it's not kept not the same, is it? It's just there's no really real London people left in Canning Town.
Was it a scary time back then?
No.
Or did you enjoy it?
What, enjoying hurting people? Of course I never. Of course I never. I just told you, I was never a gangster.
Yeah, I mean...
But when someone hurt you, you didn't go to the police. You said, well, right, you've got to do what you got to do.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, furthest thought from my mind then, and now, even... I'm a born-again Christian. I still wouldn't inform on anyone.
Yeah.
I wouldn't inform on anyone, no matter what happened. But I wouldn't take the law into my own hands now, because I'm a lot older, I'm a lot wiser.
Yeah, of course. You know? Of course. Lessons learned.
Of course, absolutely.
Did you know when you came out of prison you were never going back?
What, back to prison?
Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
Was it horrible in there?
Well, for a single person, it's like a holiday camp. But when you're married and got children, young children, Jimmy, Mark and my son Jimmy were only little boys then. And my wife was absolutely out of this world, waiting for me. Come, never missed a visit. Except for when she was ill, not well. Good friends from Canning Town, all stuck together. In fact, I'm going to a reunion Friday night with all our mates we grew up. 60 years we've been together, right? And a lot of them got nicked with me.
Yeah.
They was all innocent. A few of them done a bit of bird, but they never complained. And a few of them walked. So we're still friends today.
Yeah. Did your surname mean anything in prison?
At first, I think it did. I don't know. I never asked anyone. I'm not that type of person. But I walked around. I thought they expected a man to walk in now with two heads. But when they, after 18 months, 2 years, they know what type of person you are, and they just treat you normal, you know.
So back then, were you a nice guy?
I think so.
Yeah. Would everyone agree, apart from the person?
I think they'd agree and all.
Yeah.
There ain't been no retaliation since I've been out of prison.
Okay. Just one more thing on this, and that sort of background. The craze asked you to train them, right?
And they asked me to turn pro with them.
Okay.
Yeah. I told me dad at the time, because I was only a young boy, 18, 19. And he said, well, leave that to me, Jim. And obviously, he didn't know them as mates, but he knew who they were, obviously, because where they come from is only a couple of miles up the road, you know, Stepney. And we went round to see a friend of his at the time, who's passed away now, I won't mention his name. And he advised my dad, he wouldn't talk to me, he was talking to my dad, if he turns pro, Jim, don't go with the twins. It wouldn't be a good move. And in fact, the fella rung Sam Burns up, who was his manager. And he's the one who said, don't go, they started laughing, don't go with the twins. Anyway, so what my dad done, my dad went round and see Reggie Crane and told him that we was going with Terry Lawless and Mickey Dunn. That was it.
Why did they say don't go with the twins?
Well, look what happened to them.
Because he thought it was inevitable that they were going to wind up in...
Well, that was, you know, every week you heard something in the papers a lot, weren't they?
Did you know him, Ronnie?
Oh, I didn't know him, no. I was only a kid when... we first went to see him. We went in a pub in Stepney to see him. I just sat there, and my dad done the talking up the bar with him. I just sat there.
But legend has it that they were sort of like Robin Hoods.
But it was the twins. I didn't know them personally, so I can't comment. But I could only know what people who knew them. It's like this: if you was all right with them, they was all right with you. But if you upset them, then something's got to happen.
Yeah.
In a big way, the way they went about things, they got nicked for a couple of murders and that. I mean, you might say, well, you got nicked for a 10 murder, but that was a one-off that could never, ever happen again.
Yeah.
Losing your head and wanting revenge for something that could never happen. And afterwards, when I sit down, even now, when I think, I'm so lucky that I'm walking the streets now, because I could have got a life sentence. I think of my two kids and my wife and all my family, all good people, you know, even these people, they all know me, yeah, everyone in Canning Town, even though a lot of people have moved out, that's how it is, you know.
You were training at the Royal Oak, which you said were great days.
Yeah, that's right. Well, when I first turned professional, we was training at the Duke of Fife in East End very little, like a little room it was, and they had a log fire there. Old Bert Spriggs was there, he's dead now, poor old Bert. He used to have a fag on, he used to have one little ring, sparring the ring. And that we went on like that. I had a couple of fights there in the Duke of Fife, a couple of wins from that gym. Then we moved to the Raglan in Plasto. Gym set up there. And then one day Terry said, we're going to move to the Royal Oak gym. It's bigger. We get a proper heater in there. And oh, lovely.
Not a log fire.
Yeah, no. Proper, I've told the heater. To get down the way I was when I was doing middles, it was good.
Yeah.
But everyone was complaining about the heat. But I needed the heat to get this weight off. But because in them days, you didn't have protein and
creatine, all the supplements.
All the supplements. Yeah. It was water and meat and greens if you're going to do the weight. And that's what we've done it. It didn't affect me as a boxer. I could do 10 rounds easy because we didn't have it in there mentally. It wasn't put in our head, I believe. Anyway, so we moved to the Royal Oak. I think I opened that gym. There was a photo down there. It's gone. Someone took it. I've asked a couple of people, but I don't want to ask no more. Of me sitting on a chair, I was only about 20, my arms out like that in the corner, bandages, wraps on, Terry Lawless, Mickey Duff, Reg Guttridge, border control fella, top man then, I can't think of his name. No.
John...
And Murray Vickers, and this border control.
Not John Morris.
Before him.
Okay.
One before him. I remember John Morris, one before him. Nice man he was. Anyway, that was all round me. I saw that photo down there. And one day I come in, I was gonna ask for it. And keep one taken off and it was gone. But no one done something next to it or something. So it's common sense of it. Anyway, so that's where we opened at the Royal Oak. There was me, Rolf Scholes, good fighter, Jimmy Anson, good fighter, Billy Brown, good fighters. Had about half a dozen good fighters there, Terry. And a few coming through. And we all had our own way of training, and it was great to work there. Great, it was good.
Those were the days really before the cartel, but you've obviously mentioned the names. That was the cartel days.
It was the cartel days.
Okay.
If you boxed for Terry Lawless and Mickey Duff, well, I don't open up their games, they only done good by me.
Yeah.
You got on TV and you boxed at all the big venues. I mean, I had about 15, 16 fights pro at the Albert Hall, Wembley, and the Sporting Club, and Manor Place Baths. Some great nights at the Albert Hall. I love boxing.
That was when they really sort of constricted and took over, though, wasn't it?
Through that period.
I
was. I went back there the other day to do some cut work for people. Johnny Garton, he got beat that night, and brought back memories.
Oh, down at the Albert Hall.
It brought back memories. Yeah, I looked at that ring and I thought, now I'm in that blue corner. I must have been that blue corner when I was fighting. I knocked that Italian out over that side there.
Yeah, brilliant.
And it brought back memories, and only good memories. And I do regret in life, in one thing, that I wasn't serious enough with my training. I trained hard, but I should have had that little bit more.
Do you reckon?
A little bit more better in me. I tell these fighters now, if you live the life and you've got a bit of talent, you'll make it. Because I know fighters who didn't have the talent but lived the life and still made it.
You think the only thing holding back you was you?
Yes. You. No one else, mate.
You did, or did you not, put Muhammad Ali on the canvas?
Well, there's a story behind that. One day I was working with my dad's mate, putting a fence up over Stratford. He wanted a fence put up. We was working together. And all of a sudden, one of my family come driving round. Jim, I've got your boxing gear in the... He must have been round my house. You've got your boxing gear in the... But Terry wants to see you at White City. You're sparring with Muhammad Ali. So I went, what are you on about? I said, I'm fighting in a couple of weeks' time. He went, you're sparring with Muhammad Ali. But it wasn't a spar, it was for publicity.
Sure.
But 20 years of age. So I jumps in the motor, goes up to White City, he's driving. Goes in there, Terry's there, Mickey Duff, all the cameras and everyone was there. I think Terry Downs was there. And he introduced me to I've got the photos, I've got them on my phone and all of them, look at them. So shook hands with Muhammad Ali, Jimmy Ellis, lovely man. When I got there, I forgot my protector. Getting ready to spar. But I'm thinking, well, I'm a good fighter. I ain't as good as him yet, but I'll have a go. This is what I'm thinking in my head. I ain't gonna move.
You're not gonna bow down to him.
No, I'm gonna do what I can. And hoping that he's sensible, which is blinded what he done. Anyway, so gets the gear on. So I said, oh, I forgot my protector. So Jimmy Ellis went, here, Jim, put down, put the protector on. And it, his name's Jimmy Ellis, J-E, but not my name's James Edward Tibbs.
Okay.
Right? Edward Patrick, but I use James Edward, K down a bit. And J-E, and there I am with Ali. I give him a jab, and it just touches his head guard. I can't remember doing it, really, but they've got the photo of it. I've got it. But like that, just give it to him, like that, and it's, and there's J-E. It's come out perfect. And done something else, all of a sudden, bomb, he's hit the deck. And I thought, did I hit him? This is what I'm thinking. I don't think I did. Anyway, that photo went all around the world. And a fella down there who I mess about with, train of a morning, just to keep him happy, he went to New York on a 25-mile run, what do they call it?
Marathon.
Yeah. And I was telling him about the photo. I said it was in the New York Times. I was the first British fighter to be in the sports bit of the New York Times, something like that. Terry Lawless didn't tell me, Dean Powell told me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I said, you see me? And he went out and he went to the library and they got it. And he brought it back for me. But I already had it anyway. But that was, no, I didn't knock him down. But he was a gentleman. Great experience to say that I shared the same ring as him. I can't say the people I knocked him down. It's embarrassing. I'm a big heavyweight champion of the world. I weighed about 11-11.
What did you learn from the spar? How many rounds did you do? Half a round. In and out. You get a taste of his quickness or
yes.
anything?
Not really. But I got a taste of the atmosphere. Being in there with a world champion, heavyweight champion of the world, Angelo Dundee, Jimmy Ellis, and a couple of other sparring partners. Terry Downs.
But you weren't starstruck. You wanted to.
No, I wasn't starstruck. I wanted to look. I was up and coming, sold a lot of tickets. I wanted to look good.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I knew. I wasn't stupid. I know if he wanted to open up on me, I'm middleweight against the heavyweight champion of the world. What chance you got?
You ended up boxing on his bill?
Yes. I boxed Tom Calderwood, Chick Calderwood's brother. I don't know if you remember Chick Calderwood.
Yeah, Scott Chairman. Right. Yeah, yeah.
I boxed his brother, Tom player. Calderwood, and I stopped him in two rounds. I was on the deck. I was sitting in the dressing room, and in them days, we had the leather boots, you know.
Sure.
So I looked out at the flaps. Johnny Kramer was boxing Johnny Pritchard.
Okay.
And they were slipping all over the place. So I thought to myself, right, got a pair of scissors from somewhere, I don't know where, I must have asked from somewhere, and I started to cut my boots, the leather underneath, because when you get in the ring, get the resin in, thought of all that. And as I was doing it, I see Harry Levine come walking, this is in the old Arsenal.
Yeah.
Harry Levine come walking through, the promoter. So when he got near me, I stood up to meet my light to shake hands, and he went to me, I feel embarrassed saying this, but I'm going to say it because it's the truth. He went to me, sit down son, you're going to be a star. I've never got it. I've never quite made it, but I shook hands with him, thanked him, and I went out there and I felt like $1 million.
And did you box in front of 54,000 people? Were there that many people there for your fight?
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of them cheered when I come out. I thought Muhammad Ali was behind me.
Brilliant. When you came out of prison, you started up a scrap business, did you?
We had a scrap business before we went to prison, yeah. People looked after the yard, the business for us, so when we come out, we didn't expect to get money off of people, we're not like that, but we had a lot of good friends in business, and they gave us machinery, like grabs, and, shears, and different things that you need in a scrap yard. So we got to work, and we done well, me and my brother and my dad. He didn't do a lot of work then, we didn't want him to do a lot of work. But the yard was taken away from us, compulsory purchase from the Greater London Council. And while they was doing that, I had a little stroll up to the Oak where I used to train. And that's how I became a trainer. When I walked in there, Terry Lawless was, hello Jim, hello Tel. Telling him about the yard, I said, yeah, I'll be out of there soon. You know, told him what's happening. Oh, he said, do us a favour. I said, what's that? He said, I'm going to America for a couple of weeks. Would you give Frank Black a hand training the boys? Like, I knew them all. Mark Kayla, Frank Bruno, Charlie Magri. So I was going watching box. Ray Cattouse, Lloyd Hannigan, I can't think of them all, but you know, I went. I'd done a little bit of training down West End with the amateurs, but I thought, yeah, this is something I would like to do. Like, never thought it'd ever last. So I went down there with Frank. Oh, I said, ask Frank first, see if it's all right, and it was all right with Frank. So when I went down there, I took my pads down there. So I don't know, I think Charlie Megrin was the first one I took on there. And after I'd done a couple of rounds with him, they was all lining up the pad work. And I ain't been out of the gym since. That's 38 years ago.
Who's been the most talented that you've worked with?
I can't name one, Trish. I can't name one. It wouldn't be fair. I've worked with a lot of good fighters.
Do you know what I mean when I say who's been the most naturally gifted? You know, who do you think's come with you, you know, with some real raw ingredients that you think that's pretty special? I'm not trying to rephrase my question. It's a different question.
I know what you're saying, yeah.
You know, some people have just got it, haven't they?
Some people, well, there's Charlie Megrie, natural. Yeah. Lord Hunnigan, natural. Ralph Charles. No, I was boxing with him. I didn't train him. I was boxing with him.
But you wouldn't call necessarily Frank Bruno a natural.
Frank wasn't really a natural, no. He had a good jab, good right hand, and an hard worker. A good right hand. He didn't have much of a left hook, but he had a good right hand. When he caught someone with that right hand, he shook them up.
Just flashing back a little bit, and I definitely want to hit more of the training stuff in a sec, but during the scrap yard phase, was that when you hit the drink a little bit?
Hit the drink?
Yeah. Were you drinking? I'm sure I read somewhere that you were drinking a lot. Or was that just recreational?
Only recreational. I mean, I like to drink weekends even now, but the missus goes, don't go too strong, so I have to ease up.
Okay, fair enough.
I can't do what I like.
Okay. But Bruno, you said, wasn't a natural, but he's still got that insane work ethic, hasn't
he? Yeah, he had that work ethic, Frank, and he was a proper, proper gentleman. I've got to mention this, because years later, after I finished with the Royal Oak, he was still there with George Francis and Terry Lawless, whoever. And then he finished with them, and one day I was playing golf and he rang me up. This was in the 90s, early 90s. Jim, I'm fighting the guy who won the Olympics and never done a lot, had a lot of money out of the BBC.
Audley Harrison.
He said, I'm fighting Audley Harrison. Would you train me for the fight? So I went, yeah, of course I would, friend. Where are you living now? He said, I'm living Stondham Massey, I think it's called that, through Brentwood, Ongar Road. So I said, well, guess what? I said, go along the Ongar Road, ask anyone, they'll tell you where I live. Put the phone down. So now I thought, wow. Anyway, I found it. I went down the Ongar Road a couple of days later, found it, and got to his big mansion. And he was having a lot of work done here and a lot of work done there. But I noticed there was all different firms doing work, and I thought, they should have one firm. Even I knew that. To do all this. Anyway, none of my business. I went in there to talk to him about the fight. And he asked how the family was. He took me round his acres of ground. And he said, how's your dad, Jim? I said, he's all right. He said, well, I want to speak to him. He said, because I want to open a big fishing pond or whatever they call it, lake, big fishing lake, and I want your dad to run it for me. So I went, are you serious? He went, yeah. I said, okay. I said, I'll ask him. Anyway, he goes down there. Now he asked how I've got a grandson who's Down syndrome and a diabetic. So he asked him how he was. He knows all my grandchildren. I've got 4 grandchildren, 5 grandchildren, 3 great-grandchildren. And I said, all right. I said, we're a bit worried about James, Frank. He said, what for? I said, well, he's going to the big school soon and we don't want anyone to bully him. That'd be a big worry for us. And we didn't want that, you know what I mean? In case it causes any trouble or anything like that. And he said, I've got a school for him. Now, we lived in 7 Kings Ilford. I had a lovely bungalow there then. Jimmy lived in Dagenham, that's his son. And Frank said, there's a school in Brentwood. I'm just trying to think of the name while I'm talking. The Endeavour. A special needs school, Jim. It's nearly private. He said, it's lovely. He got on that phone. So I phoned Jimmy and Michaela up, his mother and father. Told them about it. They went, oh, Dad, that'd be lovely if you could do that. I said, I ain't doing it, Frank's doing it. Oh, thank him. Anyway, within 6 hours, he made a meet for my Jimmy and Michaela to see the headmaster. And he got in that school. That was why he was having his nervous breakdown. I didn't know that then. He was having a nervous breakdown then. But I didn't know it until I went to America with him. and that's when I found out he wasn't well. But he'd done that for my son, and I've never ever forgot that. I'd move heaven and I'll see him the other week. At the fights, went up to him, hello Jim, took hands, I went, come and get us a cuddle, and I cuddled him and he loved it. And I loved it. He's a lovely man.
So tell me, what makes a good trainer? You mentioned obviously earlier not having a one-size-fits-all approach, yeah, and you've got to treat people differently. And when you look at the people that you just mentioned, you've got Frank Bruno, yeah, little Charlie Magri, yeah, you've got Lloyd Hannigan,
yeah,
Kayla, yeah, you've obviously had Michael Watson, Nigel Bent, all, yeah, very, yeah, different stylistically. Yeah. You couldn't look at them and say, well, they're a Jimmy Tibbs fighter.
Well, that's what makes a good trainer, what you've just gone from. They're all different styles. You've got to have the ability to do their style. And not only do it, not just talk it, but when they do something wrong, you go, hold it, look, I'll show you. Off comes, and then you start shaping up, taking them off. That's what, slip and look, don't slip and do nothing. Slip up, you can either go that way to the body, or you can go that way over the top, whatever way you want to go. Now, I had the ability, I'm not being big-headed, but I had the ability to take anyone's style off to make them better. To make them better, in
so
my opinion.
Enhancing what they've already got, rather, yeah, than trying to rewrite.
Add to it. There was one fighter who was a bit of a tearaway, a good fighter, you're going to know him when I say the word. He was a bit of a tearaway, but I said to him, Jimmy McDonald, I said to him, Jim, I'd like to see you box a bit more, because you ain't that crack, bang, wallop, knock them out all day long. You become a brilliant boxer. A brilliant boxer.
Underrated.
Yeah?
Yeah, for sure. Okay. What trainers have you admired over the years?
The first trainer that I admired in this country was Bobby Neal. Because when I was in prison, they used to have boxing on Saturday afternoons, where fights were at Wembley Tuesdays, used to be Tuesdays then, with that promotion, with Duff and Lawless, that was always Tuesday nights. And you get the Saturday afternoon boxing. And I was sitting there, Alan Minter was coming on. So I thought, oh, well, I'll watch Alan. And he was fighting Emil Griffith. Bobby Neal was training him for this fight, and I noticed when he boxed. Do you mind if I stand up?
No,
there?
No, of course.
When he used to box southpaw, his arms out like that. But when Bobby Neal got him to tuck it in a little bit, made him smoother, smarter. He was always smart anyway, a brilliant boxer. But he added that bit more to him.
Yeah, sure.
And he outpointed Griffith, and he done well. And I thought to myself, he's going to go to world champion. That kid, if he gets a chance.
And he did.
Yeah.
Who else have you liked? Obviously Bobby Neal. Who else? Both here and stateside and around the world.
Bobby Neal, obviously, was the fella out in America who's got one of all the champions.
Angelo,
but the other young fella, youngish, younger than me. I've worked with him. He's got the champions. He's always...
Not Emmanuel Stewart.
Well, I admired him because he done well. He got you mentioned him. He's in California, got the big gym out there. What's it?
Freddie Roach,
yeah. I admire him. I've watched him work. I've worked with him. He knows his boxing. I wouldn't say he's a very good friend because we live opposite sides of the pond, but when we see one another, we always shake hands and, you know, he's a nice fella.
Yeah, okay.
And another trainer that I admire very much, come from New York, Teddy Atlas.
Okay.
Very good trainer.
No nonsense.
Talk, yeah.
Motivator as well.
Good motivator. When his man was fighting George Foreman.
Michael Moore.
Well, Michael Moore, right? I don't know if he was fighting George Foreman at that particular time. I mentioned George Foreman to get Michael Moore in the head.
Sure.
Right? So Michael Moore, he was... Teddy Atlas was saying, do this, do that, and he wasn't performing too well. So Teddy Atlas come back and sat down in the corner.
He sat in the stool, didn't he?
I'm not getting up. I thought that was out as well. I mean, it takes some doing that. To think of it, I'll never think of anything doing like that.
Yeah.
Doing anything like that, but yeah, it was good. The trainers I've just mentioned there were great trainers, weren't they?
What qualities do you look for in a fighter? I know obviously you're not taking on any fighters now. What have you looked for over the years?
Well, obviously talent, dedication, straightforwardness, no nonsense, coming in late, or doing this, and no messing about. You're going to train, you've got to live the life. If there's a future, there ain't a lot of future for many of these fighters in the game because it's really old. It's an old game. And to get to the top, to earn any big, big money, you've got to be something special. But now they're making these titles up now where I think it's good because it gives the middle of the road fighter to get a few quid, to get some sort of money. And but there's a fighter, since I've been doing the cuts, who I admire very, very much, Johnny Garton.
Okay.
He got beat the last fight out with
Chris Jenkins.
Chris Jenkins, yeah. Good fight, Chris Jenkins. He beat him fair and square. And when they made that match, I thought it's going to be hard. Yeah. Ones are that little bit level above, you know. And but that ain't for me to say. I'm just a cut man. But they always ask my advice. And but he just got outboxed, outpunched in the end, and he got through it in the end. And but the fight before that, when he won the title,
Corcoran,
he got cut to pieces.
That's right.
I got hold of it, and I admired him for that. He never once said to me, "How is it, Jim?" Just sat there and let me do the work. He had two deep cuts on the top of his head, and. When he went out again, clash of Ezzy bleeding again, but he got through it and stopped him in 11 rounds. Yeah. And I admire, I thought, that's one guts for the amount of ability that he's got, that's one gutsy boy. And I never ever thought he would be British champion, but he did.
Yeah, he's done
and I admired him for it.
Can't take that away from him.
No, I had more talent than he did, but I was never British champion. Mm. So I admire him for that.
What's the worst cut you've seen over the years?
That one with Garn.
Was it?
Yeah,
was it
right with Johnny Garn. Yeah, yeah. Too. Yeah.
Okay. You also like a good listener, don't you? But some of the guys, when I look at your... Did Lloyd Hannigan really listen to you all the time? Because well, he was such a character.
He liked to speak what was on his mind, Lloyd. And people used to say this about him, that about him, but there was a good side to him, Lloyd Hannigan. I've done a lot of work with Lloyd. He was a good fighter. He could box, knew how to keep his chin down. He could roll, and he could box, and he could punch. Good puncher.
Were you training him around the time of the Curry fight?
Yes.
But you couldn't get out there because of visa issues?
No, it wasn't nothing to do with that. We had a little bit of a dispute. My fault, not his. I've held my hands up and I apologised to him years ago. He accepted. We shook hands. And he became world champion. Couldn't have happened to a nicer fella. Good luck with him.
Okay. There are some big nights. You must have missed out on some big nights in America, though.
I've been to America twice. Mickey Duff got me to America. No one else can do it. I say to all these promoters, I ain't gonna mention no names. None of yous can do what Mickey Duff done. He went to me one day, I had been out of prison 5 minutes. You wanna go to America? I went, do you reckon I could? He went, go up, come back a couple of weeks later. I don't know if I should be saying this. But go to the American Embassy, Jim, asked for so and so to you. I can't remember what I said, but they went, hey, Mr. Tibbs, boom, stamp indefinite. He got me there. I went with Frank Bruno. I still had that on my passport. I went to America with Frank Bruno. Mickey Duff and Terry Lawless first. With Lloyd Hannigan, actually. The first time he fought out there. Then Bruno went out there to... we went to upstate. Buffalo, up that way.
Yeah.
For a bit of training stuff and that. Good experience. Then we went to Jamaica from there. But when my passport ran out, 10 years, I just... They cut it, didn't they, anyway? They cut it.
Yeah.
Cut it off, and so I got rid of it. But I wish I'd have kept that now. So then gone up the embassy and said, look, you give it to me once.
Yeah, yeah, you got it, yeah.
You give it to me. You but I think it's all this terrorism that ain't helped anyone, you know.
Sure. Anyone that you haven't worked with that you would have liked to have trained?
Anthony Joshua.
Why is that? I'm assuming it's not just a financial thing.
No, I don't mean that what I said. Anthony Joshua's, he's done very well. He's done very well for himself, financially and ability-wise. Because he can fight, and people say this and that. There's only, look, there's Anthony Joshua who's got the three belts. Denton Wilder, what's his name?
Deontay Wilder.
Deontay Wilder, he's got one belt. So that's your 1-2. Tyson Fury's got to be three. He's up there with him. And you've got Dillian White, 4.
Yeah.
That's the 4 top fighters around the world today, I should imagine.
Yeah, the 4 top heavies,
the
4
top heavies, yeah.
For sure. Okay. Just as an interlude, Jimmy, let me give you some quick questions, general things, just so people get a general thing away from, a little bit away from boxing. Although you can bring boxing in. What's your favourite film ever?
James Stewart, when he sees the angel come down, jumps into the water. I can't think of the name of it. Come back to that. I'll get that in a minute.
Okay. If you could have anyone round a dinner table, well known, public eye, boxing or not, who would you have?
Anyone?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Okay. All right. We'll come on to that as well. When was the last time you cried?
When the old woman had a go at me.
Favourite fighter of all time?
Sugar Ray Robinson, Sugar Ray Leonard.
Favourite fight of all time?
Oh, so many good fights out there, aren't they? Jake LaMotta, Sugar Ray Robinson.
What's the worst part of training when you were fighting? What was the bit you hated the most?
I didn't hate nothing. I loved it. Okay. Every bit.
If you could change one thing about the game, what would it be?
There ain't a lot to change now with the medical history that British Boxing Border Control have done. They've covered it. I think they've covered everything.
What's your favourite animal?
We had a dog named Ben, old English sheepdog. So that was my favourite animal. It was Mark's dog, actually. I bought it for Mark when he was a little boy.
Best book you've read?
Best book I've read. Oh, blimey, I've read so many books, I can't think at the moment. Give me time.
I'm not going to let you have the Bible.
No, I know. I was going to say the Bible, but I do read the Bible. No, I don't read it as much as I should, actually. Best book? I think the Lucky Luciano story.
Okay. I thought you were going to say Tibbs there for a minute.
No. That's what you call a gangster. Not what? Me.
Oh, I was going to say
Lucky
Tibbs.
Luciano. No, Lucky Luciano.
Okay. Yeah, for sure. Have you got a hidden talent?
Not really, no.
Superstitious at all?
No.
Okay. Through that quick list, how did you find religion? How did that come about?
Right. I've always been brought up to believe in God. So I went to two Catholic schools. But I never, like most people, I never took a lot of notice. And then when you leave school, you get a job, you go to work, you go out with your mates. So I went to boxing. So a lot of my time was spent in the gyms, different from going abroad to box and the ABAs, junior ABAs, schoolboys and all that. So a lot of my time was taken up like that. And then I got the job with Terry Lawless, training the fighters. And one day I was sitting in, I had a big house, big bungalow, lovely place. The boys were young, lovely garden.
In the East End?
No, Seven Kings, okay. Ilford. In them days, it was a nice place. And I was looking out the window, and I don't know what happened, but I know what happened, but I don't know why it happened. I just looked up and I started to think about, I wonder what's going to happen. I wonder where you go when you die. Do you die and you go to nothing? Or wonder, and I started to think about God, and I looked up at the sky and I thought, nah, it's too big. I was brought up like to believe in God, but if you're good, you go to heaven, if you're bad, you go to hell, and if you're a little bit of each, you go to purgatory, which I know is a lie because it's not in the Bible. But anyway, that's what I was saying. Then I went, I wouldn't have had a shower, go down the pub, see me mates, Saturday, day off. Went down there, but I just couldn't get it out of my head, and I thought, who can I talk to? And I couldn't think of one person who I could talk to. Now my family were all like that, my dad, my brothers, very close. But I thought, well, I can't ask them about God. They're going to start saying, what's the matter with you, Jim? What's the matter with Jimmy? So I didn't ask them. So I went along, and I don't know if you noticed that fella sitting down there who was talking at the table. Yes. His name's Benny Stafford.
Okay.
He come up, I was training the fighters in the West Ham Boys Boxing Club, pros. Dean Powell was with me, and another trainer down there who helped me out, because I had a lot of fighters. And Benny come in the gym. Now, I heard 7 years previous to while before I was in that gym that Benny Stafford, Mickey May told me, a good trainer he was, amateur trainer. He said, have you heard about Benny Stafford? This is 7 years before he came into me, Benny. I said, what do you mean? He said, he's a born-again Christian. So I said, what's that then? He said, I don't know. So I said, well, if it keeps him off the booze, it might do him a favour. Just left it at that. And one day, who comes to the gym? Benny. I said, hello, Ben. Now, you remember, he's a Canning Town boy. Mm. Same age as me, a bit younger than me. So everyone knows him in Canning Town. It was the talk of Canning Town when Benny Stafford became a born-again Christian. But I didn't take that much notice of it. So I didn't ever thought that I would become one. So he said, can I train here, Jim? So I had a feeling he wanted to train here, but he wanted to tell someone in this gym about God.
Right.
Okay. Right? Because that's his duty. So I went, all right, Ben. I said, I couldn't say no to him, the Canning Town boy. I went, yeah, come in. I said, train over there, Ben, in the corner, because these boys have all got fights. There was about 15, 16 of them. But really, I was being kind to him, but I really didn't want him telling them about God in case it upset him. You know what I'm saying? So he goes and gets on with his job, and he got to know my times when I was having a little bit of a break, because I was doing a lot of coaching then with the fighters and that. And I looked around like that, and he went, cup of coffee. So he had a cup of coffee. And one day I was in there having a cup of coffee, the phone goes. I was working with Frank Warren then, one of the promotions didn't break down, but all the shows were cancelled. All the shows. So all them fighters in there was all out of work for their dates. I went absolutely berserk in the office. Now he's come round for me. I know that, didn't know that then, but now I know. Right, he's sitting in the chair. And then while I was going off, chucking things about and swearing and carrying on, he went, Jim, you need the peace of Jesus. I went, do what? He went, you need the peace of Jesus. So I said, Ben, how long's this born again business been about? And before he could answer, I went, 10 years, 15 years? And he looked at me, he went, because it's 23 years now nearly. He went, just over 2,000 years, Jim. And I thought, in my mind, I didn't let him know, but I thought I should have known that. I learned that at school. And so it went on from there. He spoke to me about God. I didn't understand it all. But 10 months, 11 months went by, and I knew he was right. I knew he was right. So I wanted to say that prayer of salvation so I could get saved. So I drove home. I was sitting in the gym on my own that night, one night, winter night, sitting there, and I thought, no. I couldn't stop thinking about it. But I never told a lot of people because I thought he was going to listen to me. My mates are born again Christians. A few of them are now. But anyway, so.
So what was it? Was it that you needed to repent sins?
Well, it's not only that. It's not just to repent. It's not to repent to. It was knowing when I die, I want to know where I was going. I believed in heaven and hell, and I didn't want to go to hell. So that's why I done it. Okay. That's the God's honest truth. I wanted to go to heaven. Now, I would find that very hard to sit down with my family and say, this is why I'm doing this. Because they'd probably go, what's the matter with you, Jim? Something like that. So I didn't do it. But this is what happened. So after about 10, 11 months, I decided to make that commitment to Jesus. So it's all right saying you make a commitment, but it's no good you using your lips saying it. You've got to mean it with that. Because if you don't mean it with that, you're wasting your time. You've got to mean it with your heart. So I went home, found a little book with the sinner's prayer in it. Page 13 it was. I've never forgot it after all these years. And I got on my hands and knees, said, much I meant it. And I said that prayer, and I meant it with my heart. Even though I was still going to be a sinner, Jesus, when he died on the cross, he died for your sins, past, present and future. That don't give you a license to do what you like, though. Nah. He'll soon chastise you. You don't do what you like because he's died for your past, present and future sins. Right? You learn that as you go along. But anyway, the first person I told was my wife. Now, she was having a little bit of a life with me because I was always out. And done my own thing, and I was always right, and she was not right, and I was all. And it also, I went, Claude, I said, I'm a born again Christian. I'm laughing myself now. She went, how long's that going to last? So now she knows, so now I'm looking for a church round in Ilford Seven Kings. Do you know this the area out that way?
No,
it's in Essex, Ilford Seven Kings. And I thought, right, now I've got to find a church. I ain't got to find, but I'm going to. Benny said, find yourself a church, Jim. Good Christian church. So I had a ride round Ilford and Seven Kings, which I've done a thousand times, but never noticed it. But there I could see Jesus saves, Jesus this, Jesus that. It was all around me, but I've never noticed it. See, once I was blind, now I can see. That's where it comes from.
Yeah.
And I thought, right, so I went back and told Claudette, and she said, now listen, I've got something to tell you. She said, I bumped into my friend, somewhere she was out, her friend and her daughter's friend, her friend's daughter. And she said, they was talking to me, and the little girl said to her mum, Mum, not being rude, but we've got to go, we're going to church tonight. So Claudette said to her, oh, do you go to church, Lynn, or something like that was her name. She said, yeah, she said, we're born again Christians, Claude. So she said, my Jimmy's one of them. She went, Jimmy? Nah. Yeah? Oh, what church does he go to? She said, well, he's looking for one. So they said, tell him to come down to Ealing Pentecostal at Ilford. That was the first church I went to. And it was a lovely church, beautiful. I don't go there, it's all built up now. It's the man. We still speak to the pastor there. And lovely church. So I learned a lot there about the Lord. I learned a lot. And I don't know everything, but I know a little bit. I don't know everything. But that's how I become a Christian.
Has it made you a stronger person or a better person?
It's made me a better person in myself, and it's made me stronger, I would think. It's made me give me the ability to stand back now and then, wait till they've finished talking, you know, like a lot more patience. I feel in my own mind I'm not the best person in the world. I still argue with my wife.
Do you win now?
Sometimes she lets me win. No, it don't make you, you're never going to, when you become a born again Christian, that don't mean to say you're never going to sin again. No, it's impossible. Because we're living in a, what look at the world we live in, is rotten, isn't it? Come on, have a look around you. It's all around the world. Earthquakes, floods, it don't stop. Wars, rumours of wars, earthquakes, oh, blimey. Okay. And that's all in the Bible. But that's me becoming a born again Christian.
There's a lot. There's a lot to be, a lot to get out of that, and I think people will be really interested to hear that. It's given you a different clarity in your mind as well, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Things that used to let me down, and I feel so down about it. When I get let down now about things, I don't get so down because the sun's going to rise in the morning. It's going to rain. That's the way it is, isn't it?
And it's out of your hands.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask you this. You see some trainers now, particularly you see some younger trainers
coming
through.
Yeah, I've got them listening. Yeah, yeah.
They are close to their fighters, quite matey, quite pally. You haven't been accused of ever being too close to a fighter, have you?
Not to my face, I haven't, no.
But I don't think you have you? You've never had that.
Oh, I did. I had a good relationship with most of my fighters. Not a matey,
but matey. That's what I'm getting
at. No, not matey,
it's
matey.
It's one thing
no.
having a good relationship, when it's another thing being pally.
When you're in that, you're right. When you're in that gym, that's when you mates with them, if they're doing their job right. If they ain't doing their job right, you've got to sort it out. And you might not become mates with them again. But you've got to tell them how it is, especially the top fighters. But
and especially when they get near the end of their career and you can see the changes and they can't.
Slipping a little bit, you know, slipping a little bit, they are. No, I had a good relationship, but Frank Bruno used to ask me to come round his place to play chess with him. I've done that quite a few times. Barry McGuigan used to come round home and I used to go, no, I haven't been down his place since he's been down Canterbury. But he's come round home. Charlie, yeah, they're all nice fellas. You know, I've got on well with them. But it's nice to get on with your fighter if you can.
Yeah.
But sometimes everyone ain't happy in the gym.
And it's work, isn't it?
It's
you don't
work.
Want to necessarily have your work.
No,
and,
that's right.
And
sometimes you want to get away from it.
Yeah.
When you go home. So see, when I was younger, I used to be a trainer, a manager. Really matchmaker and all, because I used to ring Ernie Fossey up and different people like that. You reckon they'd be alright with this one? And manager, and it was just driving me mad. That's why I decided to leave the managing out, leave the matchmaking out. Dean Powell, you can be a matchmaker, Dean, if you want to be, and he become a good matchmaker. And I decided to stick to training, and I've done the right thing. That's where I got my, because I concentrated on that alone, so I got a lot of success out of it.
What was the best night as a trainer?
Oh, are you good? First of all, you're thinking of the world titles you've won. Yeah, they have great nights. I mean, Nigel Benn, when he fought out in Italy, won the Super Middleweight Championship. Then again, I've got fighters at York Hall, Southern Area title fights. Some of them have been like world title fights.
Because like you said about Johnny Garton there, they mean just as much to them as the world title
fights.
That
was to me, like was being involved in it. I got the same feeling as if when we won the world title. Because it was such a war, evenly matched, and the way they both, true professionals, shook hands afterwards, I love to see that.
And the lowest point the lowest point as a trainer?
My lowest point, I've got no questions about answering that one, was when Michael Watson got injured. I was going to retire after that. We went to, after we got him out the football ground where he boxed Tottenham. They took us to the wrong hospital. Not their fault. No one's fault about that. Wrong hospital. See, and it was time. You can't waste too much time when you've got a head injury.
I bet it was like slow motion for you, wasn't it?
We was in that ring. I thought it was for half hour, 20 minutes. It was 7 minutes. But where there was all fighting outside the ring, people, men, women and children getting in the ring for protection. And it went on. In the end, he was there. Then I knew I had to lay him down. Then the doctors got in. They took over then. We went to hospital. We finished up in Barts. We prayed because all his family are Christians. And he finished up. He was in a bad way at first, but he pulled himself around. With God pulled him around, I think. He'd become a Christian after that. And I just go and visit him. I haven't seen much of him lately because I've been busy in the things I do, and he's always, you know, doing something. But he became a great friend, a good man, and at least he can get about and he recognises people and he talks. He tells about people about his testimony about the fight. And even Chris Eubanks will admit himself that was one of the hardest fights he ever had, except for the light heavyweight he fought up in Manchester. What's his name?
Cole Thompson.
Cole Thompson.
I think that was a cruiser, wasn't it?
That was a cruiser. It was good fight. Yeah. Chris Eubanks was a good fighter.
Yeah.
He went up from...
Hard man as well.
Yeah, tough guy. Could hold a shot. Real tough guy. And but I admired Nigel Benn when he fought. I had Nigel Benn for the second fight, not the first fight with him, when we went to Manchester.
Yeah.
And I said to Nigel, stick to his chest and make him work for 3 minutes. Make him work. Don't just do it. Make him. Stick on him. Stick on that's what he done. And he got a point taken away because he hit him low. So I didn't see it, but the referee said it. He hit him low. Otherwise, we'd have won that. But it didn't matter. He had a title. We walked away with a title still. And the last round, right, I thought we sort of got to liven him up here to do this. He was already doing well, like that. You know, I thought we was just nicking it, like that. And he come back to the corner, and I said to him, I've got to take these glasses off. Can't break them, they cost a lot of money. I went to him, he sat down, I went to him, right, now, you've got to win this last round. Big! Remember, I was a lot younger then. Big! And he went, yeah! And he won the last round.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell me about Billy Joe Saunders.
A good fighter. A good, smart boxer.
One of those ones we said with talent.
Yeah, great talent. Yeah, great talent. I think he's got more to come. I think he's got more to come out of him.
Did you fall out?
No. He wanted to do his own thing. Like he wanted to do things a bit different to what I wanted to do. So we had a little chat, shook hands and went our own ways.
Okay. Through your career in boxing, which is quite a long time, longer than I've been on the earth, just to make you feel better about yourself. You've been involved in everything. You've seen so much. You've been involved in political disputes, fighter breakups with trainers, everything else. Has there been times where you've been burnt out? And I don't mean the Michael Watson thing, obviously, where you've thought about walking away. There have been times where you've fallen out of love with the game and been burnt out by all and just thought, what am I doing?
I've got to be honest with you, Trish, no. I've always loved it. I've always, whatever it may have been, I've always got through it, worked through it. It's been heavy. Like when I was at West Ham, training about Tony Wilson, Chris Pyatt, the good looking guy, went to America.
Not Kayla?
No, not Kayla.
He was good looking then.
Yeah, he was good looking boy. He was a good friend of mine, Mark. A very good friend. He lived around the corner, man. He's become an actor. Gary Stretch.
Oh, Gary Stretch. Yes.
So, and Mo Hussain,
yeah,
and a couple of others, they were the seniors.
Yeah.
They'd been in the game a little bit and they knew their way around.
Yes.
So I could leave them there, tell them what to do for a little bit, then come back to them. But the others, who I wanted to get in the right mood, and it wasn't working right. And then when I finished with all that lot, I had to be at 2 o'clock, I had to be at Luton to train Barry McGuigan.
Right.
Then sometimes after I finished Barry McGuigan, it was not going home after I finished with Barry McGuigan, going right to York Hall. And sometimes I'd be driving that car and I used to think, is it worth it? I was getting well paid, but is it worth it? Look at me, look. I felt like chucking him motor under and articulating. But I always got there. I got there to York Hall, done my job. And coming home one night, I was with my mate coming home. And I got to a roundabout and I went round the wrong way. Where are you going? Round the wrong way. That's where I was driving out abroad, so you forgot. But no, it's never been a time when I wanted to walk away from the game. The only time I wanted to walk away was when Michael Watson got injured. I thought, no, I'm gutted. But the church kept me in it. They come round and said, Jim, stay in it. Because people like us who are in the church, boxing people, a lot of them probably won't listen to us, but they listen to you. And that stuck in my mind. I thought, yeah, there might be something in there. And I stayed. I was always with the Lord in it, but I stayed in boxing. And I went on and on better.
Some people listen to this, know I'm writing a book on CTE, which is what's now known as punch drunk syndrome. It's the new version of it.
Yeah.
You must have seen a lot of fighters, your contemporaries from when you were fighting, their health decline over the years. Has there been a point where you've been in fights and you feel bad because you know that some of those guys are sustaining it damage that could affect them down the line?
Oh yeah, plenty of times. Yeah, you think like this: my man might be boxing someone, it might not even be my man in the ring. Two people in the ring, one's getting the life beat out of him. There comes a time when the corner's got to go, boom, that's enough. You ain't going to win it. You're behind on points. You've got to pull them out. And no fighter likes to get pulled out, but I would never ever, I've never ever done it to many, done it a couple of times, but I've never ever done it to any, for all top fighters go, Billy Joe, oh, don't never pull me out, Jim. And I always go, no, I won't pull you out. If I had to, I would. I don't care what he says. If I had to, but I didn't ever come to a situation where I thought I had to do that, you know.
Sure. You mentioned a name there, a guy who doesn't get nearly half the credit he should deserve, Chris Pyatt.
Absolutely. That was thinking in my mind. I thought, I won't bring it up. So I always tell people this, that you'll come back and sell it to me. He don't get enough credit. I was with him for 15 years. I never had one fallout with Chris Pyatt.
He was a world champion in a weight he shouldn't have even been in.
No, he's like middleweight. He got beat by John Davis
Jackson.
Jackson. I was with him then. He got
good
beat
fight,
that night.
Good
yeah, good fight. He got beat that night.
As well.
That's right. And now, when he fought Sambo Colombe, Leicester, he wasn't 100% fit, you know. I felt a bit guilty like that. And this was, you know, going through training, he said to me, Jim, listen, he said, because you could talk to Chris. He said, I've got to have, I said, can't you get this fight put back a couple of weeks or 3 weeks? He went, Jim, I can't. He said, but I want this more than anything. You know, he ain't the money now, Jim. I want this title. I've got to get it. So he could go on and earn more money, obviously. But anyway, so I said, all right, Chris, we'll do it. Don't worry, we'll do it. But in my mind, I thought, oh, he's got a job on here. You know, he's got a bit of a job. And the promoter, Barry Earn, it wasn't Eddie Earn, then it was Barry Earn.
Yeah.
He's agent, international agent, Pepe, can't think of his other name, nice man. I was outside the dressing room watching a couple of fights and Pepe come along, who's got the American over and put him in where he's putting the staying and that. He said to me, Jim, he said, this guy, he can fight. He said everything I didn't want to hear.
Yeah.
He can fight. So listen, he went, and when he does his deep breathing, that's my game, deep breathing. I taught everyone about that. As long as you've got good lungs, you can go on. They're more about the muscles, good lungs you need to keep going. And if you can fight, you'll stay there all night. He said, he's got lungs. Oh, he does his deep breathing. So in the end, I went, Pep, don't tell me no more. I've got the point. Don't worry. It's going to be all right. Anyway, I never told Chris that. I went, go out there, do this, Chris, do that. I said, sit on him. I said, Chris, you've got to sit on this guy. He's too long. Don't let him get you the length of his left jab. Get on, right on him. He went right out there, right on him. But in the end, he was doing well, beating him, right on him, right on him. But in the fourth round, he got hit with a left hook up his body, lifted him off the floor. And I was in the corner, Dean Powell, and I went, oh. So he come back, sat down. I never said to him, did that, talked about it then. I went, well, carry on, stick to him. You've got to stick to him. After half a dozen rounds, Barry Owen come along, said, he's in front. Chris is in front. So I said, listen to me, you're in front. Now stay in front. Just crack him anywhere. You ain't going to get disqualified. Do stay in front, stay in front. And in the 10th round, he set about him. And then the bell went, and they carried him back to the corner. And I went to Chris, look what you've done to him. Look, have a look. That's all through experience, see? Look what you've done to him. He went, yeah. Anyway, went out and won the fight.
Yeah, brilliant.
Great night.
Did you work the night of Kayla Christie?
Yes. And I said to Kayla, as we went out, sent her the ring, I went, stand there and don't move out of that centre. Make him circle round. Don't move out of that. That's what he done, stand there. He got chinned twice in the first round, and then he had Christie over in the first round. Good fight.
That was, you know, before my memory bank, although I was on the earth by that point. There was a big racial divide, wasn't there? A racial backdrop to
I don't think it was racial. I think it was where people and the press and boxing people fancied Christie, he was the favourite. I said to Mark Kayla, you're doing, don't worry about it, you're doing. You're too strong, too good, you're too good for him. And lots of other little things went on. And but they went up there to have a press conference, they finished up fighting out in the middle of the road. And anyway, they got fined for that, and they sold the place out over it and
settled it in the ring.
Yeah, it was a good night. I finished up training Christie afterwards.
Did you? Yeah. And he was a guy who was a natural talent. But what did he have left by the time he worked with you? Did he have much left, or was he on?
He had quite a lot left, but this is how it was with Errol Christie. Bring him in any gym in the world, it'd beat anyone.
Look world class.
Beat anyone. Don't matter what weight, put him in there, he won't hit him. But once he got in the ring for the real thing, something used to happen.
Because he did that, didn't he? He went to the Kronk, didn't he?
Yeah. Went abroad to the Kronk. Bert McCarthy took him out there. And he had one fight. He had two fights with me, I think. Two or three fights. No more than three. But the first fight he had, he come over with Angelo Dundee.
Okay.
And me and Errol, it was an Irish guy he fought. I can't think of the name. But Angelo Dundee, I got introduced to him, and I was lovely to be introduced to him. He was a top man. And he won that fight, and he looked good doing it. But the next fight, he got touched on the head, down he went. And the interview, I'm trying to think of his name. He was very nice man, but he very outward going, would ask you anything, you know, put it right on you.
Yeah.
And he's having a go at Christie. You went down on a punch that couldn't hurt a little baby, something like that.
Yeah.
I think of his name in a minute, nice fella. And I went, hold on a minute, I've got to try to get him out of trouble. I went, that was world class punches. And he went, now leave off, Jim. Now it's me and him having an argument in the ring, sort of an argument, and it was all in the papers the next day.
Brilliant.
He sort of put me in my place, which he did. I tried to get him out of trouble, you know.
Who's the best British fighter of the last 40 years?
I was with him the other week at the O2, John Conley.
Okay.
And Ken Buchanan.
Well, you've hedged bets there, haven't you?
I love Ken Buchanan.
And ahead of Calzaghe?
And another one, yeah. Calzaghe, great.
Did you work with Conte at all?
No.
Obviously, he had those great fights with Saad Mohammed, didn't he?
Yeah.
He won the title against Amir.
Yeah. No, he won the title against Amanda.
And he's just known as a massive talent, but also someone who probably didn't fulfil his potential, despite his achievements.
Absolutely, I agree with that. Yeah, he would agree with that. I know now, John.
Yeah,
he would agree with that. Lovely man to talk to.
And who's the best British trainer of the last 4 years?
Mark Tibbs.
Brilliant. Jimmy, look, I know you've parked on a restricted thing today, even though I'm sure that no one in Canning Town would have the nuts to put a ticket on your car. But I really appreciate you coming down today. It's been an absolute privilege, and it was really nice, obviously, to be in touch with you and Mark, as always, and appreciate your time.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Trish.
Thank you very
appreciate
much.
Appreciate it. Thank you. I mean that.
Thanks, Jimmy. Yeah, I really enjoyed that, mate.
Good.
Really enjoyed it.
Good, man.
As with so many of the guests that we've had on here, I could have spoken to Jimmy all day without let up. I was thoroughly engaged and thrilled by that. You can hear that Jimmy jumped to his feet a couple of times and was firing off some combinations. Fantastic stuff. Brilliant company. Really enjoyed spending time with Jimmy. Like I said earlier, we'll have to get Mark on
We'll probably have to get Jimmy on for a second take as well, because I thought that was really good and there was so much more that we could have gone into but didn't. But hopefully we'll get him back. Maybe we'll get the Tips boys together next time. Just a word of thanks, as always, to Hanson Lee Resourcing. Without them, this podcast wouldn't be going on, and we're very grateful for their support moving forwards. Hanson Lee Resourcing, who are leading providers of technology and business change professionals. Whether your business is an SME or multinational PLC, they'll work with you to identify and recruit the best permanent or interim professionals and mitigate the risk of recruitment and help retain your talent. Discover more at hansonlee.com. The guest next week is yet to be determined. Just before I was posting this, I was due to visit a famous heavyweight in London. But until it's done, it's never done. So let's see who we will have next week. Speak to you guys soon.